So as we get started here, I'd like to walk you through the four steps of taking in the good and apply those steps to whatever you wish to focus on that you experienced during that meditation. So the first step is to have a positive event become a positive experience. In other words, simply bring to awareness whatever positive experience, whatever state of mind you contacted, whatever insight even you accessed. Just bring that to awareness. Maybe a sense of contentment or singleness. Second step, really savor it. Really enjoy that experience. Relish it. Take half a minute to really become absorbed in it as a concentration practice. Third step, intend and sense, and perhaps even imagine, that the experience is sinking into you, sifting into your body like a warm sun into a t-shirt, or water into a sponge, or a jewel in the treasure chest of your heart. However you sense it, that this experience is really sinking in and becoming a part of you. So that it's more and more with you wherever you go. And then the fourth step is an optional step, but it's often really relevant or helpful. And that is to imagine, maybe with some nudging of the positive experience you had, imagine that it is going into and soothing and healing old pain or old deficits or shortages. Sometimes people imagine that it's filling a hole in their heart, or it's establishing themselves in a peaceful contentment to help remedy a discontented life, or that the sense of well-being in the experience is soothing and stabilizing a depressed or anxious mood. Whatever works for you, kind of play around with guiding this experience in to heal you in some way. Perhaps simply to balance some excessive striving. perhaps sense your body shifting in some subtle ways as this positive experience heals you and helps right your course. Okay. We took some minutes for those four steps. Very often, they're accomplished in 10, 20, 30 seconds on the fly in the middle of everyday life. Okay. How was that experience for you, that guided meditation? What did you experience? Any, what did you learn or not? What was that like?
Well, I found, and this is common, is that while I can begin to access some states that you were sort of helping us towards, there's two things that kind of toss me out. One of them is an uncomfortable sitting position, pain, and the other is sleepiness. So that's physical stuff. So I guess to put that in the form of a question, dealing with that, instead of just dealing with the kind of the fact of having a body and a mind that gets tired and sleepy, and how to minimize that so that you can continue to access these states.
It's interesting that some teachers emphasize not moving at all and using pain to kind of explode the mind in a way. And there are these legendary stories, of course, with people with excruciating knee pain or something who then somehow break through to samadhi. And I must say that I have a hunch that for every one of those stories, there are a thousand stories of needless suffering where people were just completely distracted and really didn't get much out of the sitting because they were just so preoccupied. The body is not meant to sit still for 45 minutes. Particularly an aging body. And so I think it is also true that around samadhi practices, often the instruction is, you know, if a little bit of discomfort is there and it's not that big a deal, just kind of flow with it. But otherwise, do what you need to do. I admit it. I bring Advil on retreat. It's an aid to practice. So for me, at least, time and a place for everything. The second thing, and then I'll do you just a sec, is it's also suggested that to try to do certain kinds of practices, like concentration practices, particularly when you feel alert. So I went after this just in the sequencing of a day long in the afternoon. Oh well. But in general, trying to promote awakeness and alertness is good. Ways to do that are to brighten the mind by breathing. Inhaling a lot will help. Oxygen is to the brain what gas is to a car, or deliberately sitting up straighter, or just revving up with some intensity. And sometimes it's just not going to ignite. Liftoff will not happen, Houston, today, and move on. But at those other things, I think are really important. It's okay, you know. Okay, great. Yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine went to Burma and sat with Goenka,
mm-hmm.
who takes these Westerners who spent most of their lives sitting in chairs and says, no, if you're going to be a Buddhist, you're going to sit on the floor. And then use the pain as an object of meditation, and right before my friend's eyes, and my friend is a, you know, therapist, these people would cause themselves a substantial permanent damage.
In their body, you mean?
In their body.
Yeah. So, a time and a place.
The pain is a useful message.
Yeah. Anybody else? Yeah, please.
I tend to have a problem with guided meditations. They sort of bring up a resistance in me.
Sure.
And then when you throw the words out, it tends to, you know, it may not be at that particular word, or maybe beyond that particular point, and it tends to throw me around.
Well, I really totally hear that and understand that, and I think of them as a little bit a necessary evil. So I try to do minimal instruction and set it up. I just acknowledge that. It's true, you know. I think that the point is to, once one has sort of methods under one's belt, then to obviously go on your own. I also know a number of people who really like guided meditations because it brings them back. So, you know, there's some diversity there as well. But I'm entirely sympathetic to that view. I personally prefer the fewer words, the better. And that's what I try to do when I give the instructions myself. But thank you. Okay. How about the sequencing? How was it for you? Could you differentiate bliss, happiness, contentment, tranquility, and then deepening singleness?
Yeah, for me, I'm just noticing where it was in my body. Like, bliss is more like here. And then, as I was going to kind of contentment, I felt it kind of lowering and then kind of even going to the feet.
Huh.
And kind of really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other people? How was that for you? Yeah.
I guess I have a question about singleness. I normally do gravitate toward that, but on this meditation, I was really following the guidance. And I got to the point where you were talking about being aware of the whole body at once and all of the breathing at once. And then when we transitioned, and I was able to follow every single breath, but the transition at the end to singleness, I was having a hard time. I had my little mountain, my little triangle. And I tried to do it as a whole, and then I tried to come down to, you know, just point of my nose like I typically do, but I had a real hard time transitioning from, because I opened up, which is not normal for me, and then I had a hard time coming back in.
Yeah, and truly there are many different guiding instructions, and different things will work for different people.
I guess what my question is what type of signal
singleness
did you have?
Yeah, so in the first part, remember what I said, see if you can be aware of the breath as a whole, and then see if you can be aware of the body as a whole. That notion of whole body awareness is one of those areas where I think understanding how the brain works adds value. In that, normally what happens is that we make these micro jumps over the course of a single breath. We're aware of this part, then we're aware of that, and we're aware of our leg, then we come back to the nose, right? Kind of moves around a little bit. And when we're aware of the sense of just the breathing as a whole, particularly in the torso, typically, maybe inside the throat as well, that's a gestalt kind of awareness, which really activates the right hemisphere. So when you activate the right hemisphere, reciprocal inhibition, you downregulate verbal activity. So you get a quieter mind. So a pathway into a quieter mind is awareness of wholes, like the whole body of breath. And it's very interesting that in the Anapanasati Sutta, the third step, so first you're aware if you're breathing in or breathing out, then it's breathing in long or breathing in short, breathing out long, breathing out short, and then it's awareness of the whole body of breath. And people take that ambiguously, like it could be one of two meanings. One meaning is to be sort of aware of the breath as a whole, in terms of time. The other way of looking at it is to be aware of the breath as a whole at each moment of now. And I suspect it's both. Either one's okay. But the latter one has a lot of neurological payoff because you're really promoting right hemisphere awareness. And then when you go further to the whole body, you're really getting that right hemisphere activity, which quiets, you know, the mind, quiets verbal activity. And it's kind of foundational. Then later on, to what is singleness? A lot of people talk about akagata, singleness, differently. It's interesting. What is it? Generally, people describe it as there's not much thought, if any at all, very little verbal activity, so there's a lot of quiet. It's characterized as equanimity. There's very little. That's why I went there after tranquility. You know, tranquility is a doorway to equanimity. Equanimity defined as pleasant or unpleasant may arise, although at that point the mind's quite quiet. There's not a lot of pleasant, not a lot of unpleasant. But whatever there is, the mind doesn't resist the unpleasant or reach for the pleasant. That's equanimity, okay? Which means, neurologically, that the brain as a whole is not responding to amygdala signals. The amygdala is pulsing signals, chase the pleasant, fight the unpleasant, and the brain is kind of not reacting. When you're really, really calm or tranquil, you're not having reactions. When you're equanimous, you're not reacting to your reactions. It's much more fundamental. Equanimity is one of the seven factors of enlightenment as well, and it's the technical meaning of equanimity is a deep thing in Buddhism.
Can you say that one more time, what you just said? Just that last sentence, the difference between...
Yeah, calm, you're not when you're calm, you're not having reactions. When you're equanimous, you're not reacting to your reactions. Okay. So when you're calm, it's not particularly pleasant or unpleasant. If you're equanimous, there's tremendous stability and spaciousness are the two hallmarks of equanimity. And unpleasant may arise, comes and goes. Pleasant may arise, comes and goes. There's not a, you're perfect, you're equally near to all things in the traditional saying. You're not trying to move closer to the pleasant, you're trying to get distant from the unpleasant. So you see, equanimity is much less state dependent. In other words, calm is pretty dependent, whereas equanimity, it can be equanimous under almost all, you know, all conditions, basically. So we're talking about characteristics of singleness. Little verbal activity, very quiet, lots of equanimity. And then people talk about a one-pointedness. There's, you know, you're like right there. There's not a wavering of attention. So applied and sustained attention are pretty present, but they're becoming increasingly automatic. Also, a term that's used is unification of awareness. I find that a very interesting term. Sometimes that's the leading definition of singleness as the fifth jhana factor. What in the world is unification of awareness? For me, what it corresponds to is when I drop into that state in a way that feels true to me, which then is often a doorway into the jhana. In a moment, I'll talk about what are the jhanas? There are two main ways of defining them and some of the implications. But it really has that feeling of like everything just kind of comes together. Like all of experience is experienced as like one whole thing. That's what I was trying to get at. And I suspect at that point what's happening, which is partly why I used this suggestion of strengthening and spreading sense of unification of awareness. There have been some studies that people, Tibetan practitioners who are meditating, and they're very absorbed in their meditation, they have a lot of gamma wave activity. Gamma wave are fast waves, 30 to 80 beats a minute. That's a lot of neurons or neural population spread way across large regions. I mean, at the scale of the brain, from here to here is like Reno to San Francisco. But they come into synchrony with each other. So literally you have these neural populations discharging, firing, in harmony, in rhythm with each other. You know, beating, like clapping hands 30 times a second. And What there is a spreading and intensification of that gamma wave entrainment of large areas of the brain, which strikes me as very likely to correspond to the unification of awareness, because you really are unifying large swaths of neural real estate, including major regions, as we'll see tomorrow, that are involved in conscious awareness. You know, what is consciousness, right? See? So I suspect that part of that sense of unification of awareness corresponds to gamma wave activity, and that it's achieved in part by just kind of opening to a sense of it. It's just all one thing. That's how I experience it. That's what I'm meaning. My instructions may or may not have helped you get there, but at least that's what, to me, is the plausible neuropsychological, you know, instantiation of these esoteric words that have been handed down to us across thousands of years from people who've gone really deep. Okay. Yeah.
That was the closest that I have ever had, of consciously dropping into those states, although in meditation lately, I've been identifying it as happiness. I've noticed, you know, a natural smile and then just enjoying that state. But I think my German superego needs to hear you say, like what you just said, that is the normal sequence that yogis have experienced for centuries. And there's nothing given about that. It's like I was starting to, you know, go off on the fact that I wasn't sure what bliss was. And, you know, whereas if I was just to go with it, it was beautiful and I had that sense of singleness, but it just wasn't quite following the instructions, and big deal. And then another part of not, so I want you kind of just for you to say that again. And then the other part is that I tend to have an affective emotional response, which is very sweet and has a slight tinge of sadness to it. And it feels totally, it's pleasant, but I haven't ever heard a description of the jhanas that there was a affective emotional outpouring,
right,
as a part of that. And so there again, am I wrong? Is it okay?
You know what I'm saying?
Well, thank you. I think the next slide actually is the traditional description of the jhanas, and so let's keep your question in mind as we read that there.
Okay.
People vary. You know, I think my observation is that what we're getting to, and I think definitely some of you were there, is what's called access concentration, where you're at the doorway. You're accessing it. You're knocking on the jhana's door, knocking on heaven's door. You're knocking on jhana's door. And to that, where I hear the greatest variability is around whether people experience much bliss or not. Some people experience tremendous bliss, kriyas. They're just, this is vibrating. I personally think a fair amount of whatever's going on neurologically with that is happening, and sometimes in ecstatic Christian prayer meetings. You know, it's not just in Buddhism. You know, ecstatic Jewish practice or Sufi dancing, or, you know, just a lot of ways to bliss, right? Tantra, you know, is an interesting doorway there, for example, as well. So that one's pretty variable, but the general process of steady, quiet, single, concentrated. I think the Buddha laid it out like that for a reason. And those phrases have survived in that order for a reason, because that's a common path. But people vary. Like, there are a lot of reports of people who have no spiritual background suddenly dropping into some kind of God consciousness or unitive non-dual awareness and either having it be a one-off that they never go back to again, or actually are miserable trying to recreate, or being the basis of a transformed life right then and there. So, and there are other people who do a lot of mental training, and then they really start tipping into these places. You know, the sixth day of retreat, the tenth day of retreat, the tenth year of practice. Yeah. Okay. What?
Yeah, there's some people who don't have
it. Yeah, exactly. And who have often wonderful insight and fantastic sila. You know, maybe they don't have a lot of samadhi, but they have a lot of sila and a lot of panya. A lot of, you know, restraint and virtue. They have a lot of virtue and a lot of wisdom. And that's cool. You know, because wisdom actually is the ultimate fruit. You know. So. Okay? And then you want to talk about the jhanas?
Yes. Actually, I was just kind of wondering about the act of breathing itself.
Yeah.
And the qualities of breathing and what's happening in the brain. For example, if there's a shallow breath or deeper breath.
Yeah. Two things there. Well, this might be a partial response, you know, and then see what's left, okay? One is, I just want to call out the instruction or suggestion of following the internal sensations of the breath. Very often, we're to be aware of the breath almost peripherally, and that doesn't tend to activate the insula so much. So I'm going after the insula, right? Because I want to have that beneficial side effect of getting in touch with yourself, oneself emotionally, and activating one's empathic capacities. And interoception, the sensation of the internal, cool air going in, warm air going out, or the movement of the joints, or the movement of the internal musculature, you know, that of the chest that expands and contracts, that's going to really stimulate insula activity. So that's something to think about for yourself. And it's interesting to start there sometimes. I find for myself that I tend to start there, and then I settle in here where it gets subtle and it's not so distracting as all the sensations. But again, whatever works for you, whatever works. The other thing is the suggestion about giving up control of breathing. Did any of you experiment with that? That's kind of interesting, to give up control of breathing. Literally to the point that you are willing to not breathe, which gets really close to willing to die. Breath is so fundamental to life. But when we give up control of breathing, it's a deep surrender practice. And it really tends to reduce the sense of the activation of self. To just surrender so profoundly in that way, till the body takes over. Yeah. And then people do vary in your breathing. And it's often said that, it is true that as we go further and further, one of the hallmarks of meditative practice as a marker is how quickly people go into very light and relaxed breathing. Because they're just fairly quickly, they get massive parasympathetic arousal. Their body gets very quiet metabolically. They don't need much oxygen, and their breathing just slows down. That's a research study marker for meditative practice. It's not always the case, but it's often the case. Okay. Yeah. And it's perfectly normal, too, for breathing to be irregular. Particularly if you let the body breathe on its own. It'll breathe shallowly. Then after a handful of those, it'll need more air, need more oxygen, a couple deep breaths, and then that's kind of alive and then settles down and gets quiet. You know, it's really okay. It's all okay.
I guess what I'm having trouble with is when I get perfectly still.
Mm.
There is no more breath. And I know I need to stay focused on the breath in order to keep going into jhana, but the breath will disappear and there'll be nothing. It's just stillness. And I'm having trouble having the stillness or the breath. To me, there's a duality there. I can't, because stillness seems like it's singular.
Yeah.
And yet I'm not perceiving the breath anymore. And right. I know I need to stay on the breath in order to keep going to jhana. And so I'm getting confused.
Ed, do you know the book Living Dharma? Jack Kornfield gathered 12, at the time, living, masters in Southeast Asia, writing about practice. It would be in my top five stuck on a desert island Buddhist books, Living Dharma. I've seen it in Christie's library right here. It's really, I found it quite extraordinary because it's people not talking theory. They're all talking practice, and they're all realized or close to it. So I want to tell you a little sidebar. My friend Patrick, my monk friend, I of course asked him the question, did you meet any enlightened people? And what were they like? And of course, right, I don't know. And he said, well, it's interesting. First of all, in that framework of monastic practice and deep, deep practice, you know, and people being off in the forest and just coming out every so often, and it's not like you can look at somebody and tell. You need to hang out with them for 10 years to really know. In other words, you observe them in daily life. Isn't that an interesting thing? It's not like we have a realization and now we have an enlightenment intensive when we're proclaiming in the West, you know, for $100 a pop in our hotel ballroom, you know, that we've had an enlightenment experience. You have to watch people for a long time. And he said, and the thing that you see about people who are considered to be enlightened or close to it, you know, they're in the four stages of awakening, is that, one, they have a lot of energy, and they're just very productive and active, and they often don't need much sleep. And the second thing, as he said, is that they're always the same, in that if you're nice to them, they really love you. If you're awful to them, they really love you. They may send you out of the temple because it's not appropriate. What you're doing is just not appropriate. But they really love you. They don't change. Which is to say, it's a mind where greed, hatred, and delusion no longer arise. That's the operational definition in Buddhism of awakening. And I like that because it's operational and you can observe it. Does greed, hatred, or delusion arise, particularly under stress? So, what's interesting, among other things, in that book, Living Dharma, is when all these 12 people are talking about their practices, and they're all basically saying, this is how to get there. This is how I got there. This is how you should get there. And they're living in a structure that's quite authoritarian. You know, I'm the teacher. I know. I've been there. I'm an expert. This is how to do it. In that frame, what's startling and interesting is how different the instructions can be. All right? And that, here we are again, the D word, diversity. And I think that goes to a couple different things. One, it goes to that they're different paths and they're different people. And what worked for one person may not work for another person. It's really okay. It reminds me of, I don't know if you ever saw this movie made of Carl Jung toward the end of his life in the early 50s in England. He came to talk to a bunch of psychiatrists, I think at Tavistock, I think that was where it was. But anyway, and at the end they asked him, of course, their big question. So who's right, you or Freud? And he smiled, this wonderful smile. He said, well, I think there are some people who have a Freudian psychology. And there are some people who have a Jungian psychology. And so if you have a Freudian psychology, that's probably a good path. If you have a Jungian psychology, this is probably a good path. It's like that, right? He didn't get into it. He said there are different kinds of people. I think that's quite lovely. So about the contact there. For some people, being aware really in a localized area gives them a headache, or it's tense, or it's too effortful. There's something about it, it's too focal. It just doesn't work. And what actually works is a more diffuse focus. The breath in general, not even localizing a target on the breath, or even a sense of the breath of the whole, or, you know, here you have all these people talking about tension to the upper lip, and then you have Mahasi Sayadaw talking about the belly and verbal noting, rising and falling, which was, you know, who knew? Number one. Number two, often what happens is that what we do is it gets very, very, we're to be aware of the sensations, not the concept. Aware of the sensations quiets the verbal process, takes us out of verbal abstraction, draws us into the right hemisphere. And it's not unusual that we habituate sensation, so we stop really noticing very much sensation there. But there still is an awareness of inhaling or exhaling, and we're there. And it's really okay that the object of awareness move from the sensation. The Anapanasati Sutta, the object of attention leaves the breath by after the third step. You're into tranquilizing the breath, the, you know, the bodily formation. Then you're into, if I remember correctly, rapture, then happiness. Then, if I remember correctly, you're into attention to the feeling tone, and then attention to perception, and then tranquilizing the feeling tone and tranquilizing perception. And then that's only like about half of the 14 steps, right? So it's really okay to find what works for you and to not get stuck in some instruction. There's the other pitfall, which is to try so many different things. It's often best to pick your horse and ride that horse for a while and then see where it gets you before you change horses.
Yeah. I guess what I'm struggling with is, to me, when I'm sensing the breath, then there is a breath and there is a body, and there's a duality.
You mean the breath is distinct from the body, or the object of attention is distinct from the knowing of the object?
I guess maybe a better word than breath would be air. I'm aware that there's air, and there's the body that's sensing the air.
Okay.
And that's where I'm finding the duality. And when I combine those and I find a singularity, then it's stillness, but I'm not aware of the breath anymore. It feels almost as if I'm holding my breath, but I know I'm not. I have to be breathing, but...
That's fine to me. Sounds like stillness then becomes the object of absorption. You're absorbed in stillness. Sounds like. And the instruction generally is to be aware of sensations. On the other time, often people will use metta phrases as an object of awareness, object of attention, right? You know, may I be happy, may I be safe, may I live with ease, and so forth. That's pretty verbal. It works still for a lot of folks. You know, it sounds good to me. I mean, ultimately, what's the point? The point is to establish a state of quiet so that the mind... there are two points. You may have heard this metaphor. I like it a lot. It's the idea that we find ourselves lost in a forest of confusion and suffering, and we got to get out of the forest. So we need to break a trail to get through the forest. So good point. Good news number one, we don't have to cut down the whole forest. We just have to find our own trail up to the mountains, you know, up and out of the dusty plains. Beautiful. Second, to make that trail, we need a blade that is both hefty and sharp. And the heft of the blade is concentration, samadhi. It's that microscopic laser-like focus into the minutiae of moment-to-moment experiencing. That's the weight of concentration that we develop through training. Vipassana is the acuity of the blade. It's the sharpness of discerning attention and intelligence. If you have a dull machete, it's hard to get out of the forest. If you have a really sharp razor blade, it's hard to get out of the forest. You need a machete that's as sharp as a razor. So, the ultimate point is insight. And so if it serves one to settle into stillness, and then on the basis of that, start developing insight that's often nonverbal, just a knowing or a seeing or a disenchanting very often. It's a waking up from enchantment that's insight. There's no longer enchantment there. It's not like we have insight. It's not like we have more insight. It's like we have less enchantment. That's good. That's good. It's good practice. Yeah. And then I do want to talk about the jhanas, and because those are regarded as a singularly efficacious launch pad. And as to why it is that concentrated attention to something that's boring, that the brain would normally habituate to, like the sensations in literally a square quarter inch, why would that tip us into these states of rapture? I have no idea. I can't figure that out yet.
Oh, I thought you were
going to
tell us.
No, but it does, doesn't it? You burrow into it, and then you can pop into bliss often. So, I don't know. But, pardon me, Anne, is that right? Did you have a comment or a question? And then we can go into the jhana thing.
You actually answered in passing. So
okay. Okay, great. Yeah. The thing I will say, though, actually, is if you haven't ever done this, it's pretty great, I think, if you're so inclined, to take about 6 months or so of householder practice and just go after concentration. Just sit down and say, okay, number one, make a commitment to meditate every day. That's a good one, for 1 minute or more. That's like a very good commitment to make. I nominate it for you. If you haven't already made it, 1 minute or more, you will not go to sleep without sitting upright and meditating. Lying down and spacing out does not count. Okay? And beyond that, if you have a regular sitting practice, which is great, particularly if it's in the morning when you're alert, especially alert, to just say, I'm here to absorb in the breath. And it's like, what I like about concentration practice is very straightforward. I'm not there on the couch to just space out. I'm there, like I am when I go to the gym, to lift the weights. That's it. Everything else is my storyline. So, for whatever time you want, if you have never done this, to just say, okay, I'm going to go after each breath from beginning to end for 45 minutes or 20 minutes, whatever your duration is. Sometimes it's best to pick a shorter duration, but then, you know, with your benevolent grandmother inside, really go after every single breath. Okay? Think about it. That's good. That's a good practice if you've never done that. Okay. Okay? So, jhanas are bust. Here we are. So, do you have that slide where this is the traditional statement of the jhanas? Okay, you got that one? So, it's really interesting to go through those words and actually consider that they are. This is like a repair manual for the Volkswagen. This is an operating manual. This is how to do it. This is Julia Child's telling us how to make a souffle that works. And this is the Buddha telling us, okay, these are the jhanas. So what is right concentration? Let's go through the first one. So secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters into upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. All right. So let's unpack that with some key phrases there. So first is secluded. That means disengaged from the immediacy of householder life, either long-term as a monastic or short-term as one of us. We're pulled out. Okay. Second, we're pulled out of unwholesome states, which means the five hindrances are not present. One of the things you may have noticed as we edged into singleness, to whatever extent you did, is that the five hindrances started to fall away, probably. In other words, there wasn't that much greed, because if you're contented, contentment, I wanted to say this earlier, so I'm going to say it now, contentment is really underrated. Like I said earlier, contentment is a momentary experience of non-grasping, of no clinging. In other words, when you're contented, it's almost like a taste of enlightenment. It's not the full thing. It doesn't have the full breadth and depth of it, and definitely not the continuity of it, and it's caused. So in that sense, it's unstable. But it is a really good taste of non-clinging, to be contented, where there's no wish for this moment to be anything other than what it is. Right? So if you're contented, right off the top, bam, greed, hatred, out. You're not grasping, that hindrance is gone. Hatred's gone, gone. See? 2 out of 5. Good stuff. Doubt. Not much sense of doubt, is there? Doubt is often considered the most pernicious hindrance, because you can always doubt. You know the whole thing, I think, therefore I am? Really what it is deeply is Descartes was, I doubt, therefore I am. He was trying to figure out whether he existed. So any proof of existence, he could doubt. But then he realized he could not doubt that he was doubting. So I doubt, cogito ergo sum. I doubt, therefore I am. See, you can always doubt anything. Doubt is very, very corrosive. And you know, you don't really watch doubt. But when you're just absorbed and it feels good and you're there, it's self-evident. There's not a lot of basis for doubt. often not much restlessness, right? Because you're there. It's positively emotional. It's sweet. Which gets at what you were saying, and Susan was saying, and I'll get to more in a moment. So there's not much, you know, sense of restlessness, and nor is there much remorse, right? Okay? So what do I have here? I have, oh, torpor. Sloth and torpor. Maybe there's some sloth and torpor for some sleepyheads, but in general, if you're there and you're concentrated, you're pretty energized. Not much sloth and torpor there. So, and secluded from unwholesome states, but also secluded from sensual pleasures. Did that. Okay, good. So we got the five hindrances. Now you're in the first jhana. We didn't get there. But what are the attributes of the first jhana? So the applied and sustained attention are there. In other words, deliberate attentiveness are there, are still present. We're still deliberately attentive. There's still a little bit of willfulness, okay? Which means often there's still some subtle sense of self. You can be willful without a sense of self, but typically there's still some sense of self in there. There's also rapture, to go to Susan's point. It's blissed out. You know, the first jhana, people are often talk about it as like, oh, wow, this is amazing. This is better than orgasm. This is awesome, and it just keeps going, right? And also happiness, you know, rapture and pleasure. Pleasure is a synonym for happiness, sukha. So we have PT and sukha, rapture and happiness. Those are all present. It doesn't name singleness, but singleness is presumed. Little detail. People define the jhanas differently. Okay, the two main distinctions which you may be aware of are, you'll notice that in this traditional description from the Pali Canon, which is our best guess as to what the Buddha actually said and taught when he was alive, there is no requirement that you lose sensory awareness. Right? There's no statement here that you've lost touch with the world. Correct? On the other hand, some teachers say, Ajahn Brahm among them, I don't know for sure, Pa Ak Sayadaw may well say it as well, that you need to lose sensory awareness in order to truly be in a jhana, where literally you don't hear sounds, you don't see sights, you don't sense physical sensations, you just like that. I've never experienced that. I have experienced the first two jhanas numerous times, and the third and the fourth a bit. That's the extent of my own personal practice. And during those, I was always aware of what was happening around me. If a door opened because someone had to go to the bathroom, I would hear the door. If a bird called, I would hear the bird. Some teachers would say, that's not jhana. That may be cool. That's not jhana. You decide for yourself. I asked Christina Feldman this question. I'm like, what's true? Okay. And she, in her lovely English, do you know Christina at all? She's always worth coming to see. Maybe you'll get to have her here sometime. I highly recommend her. Very unassuming and very profound and very... And she laughed. She said, well, maybe there are multiple jhanas. If you know the Yoga Sutras, the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, the jhanas are said to be distinct from the samadhis. So there are probably multiple states of non-ordinary awareness. It's really okay. Just the Buddha called these out as the basis for liberating insight. Maybe because he trained in that yogic tradition, or maybe he felt that they had some particular value for liberating insight, because that's always what he's after. He's after insight. That's his aim. He says, I teach one thing, suffering and its end, achieved through liberating insight. Okay, so who knows? And I think that's interesting to consider. But that said, what Christina told me was that, well, maybe there are different kinds of jhanas, and maybe there are even milder versions of the jhanas. I mean, sometimes people get a kind of jhana-like moment, and then it crumbles. It can't stabilize yet. So part of what practice is to increasingly stabilize these states. And maybe jhanas, while sustaining sensory awareness, are really deep, and yet jhanas where you have no sensory awareness are even more fruitful for liberating insight. I can't speak to that personally, but that could be, to me, a very plausible way of thinking about it. Okay? Any questions or comments so far?
Someday they'll do brain scans and we'll be able to see, maybe.
The Wellspring Institute, we have two guys who have gotten scans of Lee Brazington going through the eight jhanas, including their four form jhanas. These are called form jhanas, and then there are the four formless jhanas, base of infinite space, base of infinite consciousness, and so forth. And what's really interesting is preliminary data. It's one case study, right? But with EEGs and also in a scanner, an MRI, that's the only data I know about of anybody that's like hard data. This is all beginning stuff, but it's very interesting, and I'm going to email it to people in general. Somebody has a cell phone, maybe, I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Oh, we'll let it go. No worries. That's pretty neat. So, but you're right. But it is interesting that some of what you would think would happen that would correspond to these descriptions really does seem to happen plausibly in the brain of someone like Lee. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
That's pretty astounding. He was telling us about that when he was
Going
through that.
Yeah, and we're going to publish the data. And for what it is, but if you think of medicine, because I'm a therapist, I'm in that kind of healthcare world, a lot of early medicine is case studies, like HIV/AIDS. Basically, this doctor just began discovering that, like Kaposi's sarcoma, this very unusual cancer, was very frequent. And the common thread was that all those guys were gay, you know, and then that was the beginning. It was a case study, so it's case study data, but still it's pretty interesting stuff. Okay. So then if you see the rest of them, you can see the characteristics as you move through. In the second jhana, applied and sustained attention fall away. That means that probably anterior cingulate activity falls away, and at that point, it's almost like you're just looping on attention. You're absorbed in the object of awareness, which is often the jhana state itself, supported maybe by attention to the breath or some other object of attention. But there's no longer deliberate attention, right? Applied and sustained attention have fallen away, but there's still rapture and pleasure. There's still piti and sukha. Then in the third jhana, piti falls away. No more rapture in the third jhana. So you're probably not anymore getting these massive surges of pleasure hormones and pleasure neurochemicals, the natural opiates. You know, if you're getting a lot of rapture, you're probably getting a lot of endorphins and natural opiates in the brain. But those tend to fall away as you go deeper into the third jhana. You're not getting that rapture state of mind, and you're getting a lot of equanimity. It's said traditionally that the Buddha, in his own night of awakening, that he had his insights in the third jhana, because it's said that when you're so deep in the formless states, it's hard to have the kind of insight that it's described that he had that developed into the Four Noble Truths, you know, around clinging. And it's also said that when he would meditate, he would just drop into the third jhana, you know, a pleasant abiding. Pleasant abiding. And then last, we have the fourth jhana. It's no longer a pleasant abiding. In other words, pleasure and pain have just really fallen away. It's profound equanimity. So there's not even a sense of the pleasant. There's no more Vedana going on, which neurologically is remarkable to contemplate, because we evolved to track pleasant and unpleasant sensation constantly to guide us to negotiate our way through life, approach or avoid. So imagine a brain where the pleasant and the unpleasant have completely fallen away, and what there is a kind of sublime equanimity, which, while not pleasant, is yet wonderful. That's what people say, and my own limited experience with the fourth jhana would be something about that. There's just something about, you know, it reminds me of this saying, the Buddha described at some point, the highest happiness, which is peace. It's like it's just peace. Okay. So those are the four jhanas. You know, and you can see this description to me is very plausible. And I like it because I can understand it. You know what I mean? It maps to experiential elements of an experience, and also what might be going on in the brain. So now just to unpack this a little bit, the first jhana, actually I think I've walked through these next three or four slides kind of directly. Maybe what we could do for a moment is just back out and talk about this. What do you think about this? What do you want to know about it? How does this make a difference to you? Say again?
How accessible are the chimes? Regular folks can get there.
Well, I think the answer to that is totally yes. Now, as you know, as is widely known, of course, in many ways the Buddha was, for his time and place, really quite radical. The caste system wasn't yet fully congealed, but to whatever extent it was established, like Brahmins and you know different groups, anyone could attain enlightenment, and including women. You know that was radical at the time. Men and women, monastics and householders. That was really radical. Some of my favorite suttas are by women. I don't know what it is. I mean, I have a feeling in that direction, but maybe there's something about that, you know. But there's some suttas that are just really intense and deep from women at the time who were highly respected in that profoundly patriarchal, you know, socioeconomic culture. So the offering is to us all. Now, the Buddha did describe, he did say that, you know, people vary, and some people have more or less dust in their eyes. And he also did describe householder life as dusty. And he encouraged people to go forth into homelessness, as it were, to be a monastic. And how I interpret that myself is that, I mean, with a lot of diffidence and not knowing, but kind of my guess is that monastic life really does have some special supports for focused practice. And the takeaway point is practice. You kind of get what you earn in this practice. I mean, you come into it through whatever your disposition and you know and environmental factors are, nature and nurture. You know, you start with whatever nature and nurture has been. And who knows, maybe you also start with factors that are the fruits of previous lifetimes. Who knows? And then you take it from there. But the question is, how far do you take it from there? You know, what is the level of dedication to practice? To whatever extent do you kind of say, this is where I am, what's the next step? And I think that traditionally, jhanas are considered a really significant attainment. And they're not casually attained at 10 days on retreat or at 7 days on retreat. Some people do, but a lot of people don't. So it may be appropriate to think about, you know, more sustained practice, right? Or carving out more time for practice for yourself. Or in your own life, saying, okay, 45 minutes a day, I'm going to stabilize access concentration. I think that's a reasonable goal for most people in householder life. You know, 45 minutes a day, I'm going to go after stabilizing, you know, access concentration, where I'm on the edge of the jhanas, but my mind is very quiet, very still, very present, very stable, and really happy. And the momentum of that depth of practice, 45 minutes a day is all, really carries throughout my whole day. And that's very legit. And then on the basis of that, when you do go on retreat, which is highly recommended if you've never gone on retreat, you know, as I said to my family when I came back from my first one, nothing is as powerful as nothing. You know, you're just not doing anything, and it blows your mind open. It's like, this is really weird. But anyway, because I have a life with a lot of something in it, some things. Anyway, then you have a foundation achieved through that, you know, regular sitting practice that has depth to it. Then, wow, you've really built a launch pad so that when you can really ignite the rocket ship, you just, you know, hit escape velocity and go into orbit.
So, yeah. I mean, Lee says if you have a good daily sitting practice, something like 90% of the people that do a month-long jhana retreat with him get to, you know, at least several jhanas.
Right.
But I think the caveat is that daily practice.
Yeah, it really helps. And people vary, too. You know, and let's remember, the jhanas, so-called, are 1/8 if you will, of the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's said sometimes the whole path could be summarized in wise effort. In other words, moment to moment to moment, do what you can to encourage a little bit more of the wholesome, you know, and discourage the unwholesome. Or one little detail, I think about my own background as a rock climber, and I've taken hundreds of people, beginners, out climbing, and I kind of do this as a demo, which is that I've seen people routinely, let's try not to knock over my stuff, including my thing, people routinely will be in a position where they don't know what to do. They're like this. What do I do? You know? What do I do? Right? Because they can't see anything, because nothing is within reach. They're up here. I can't get there. I can't do anything. What can I do? Right? Well, what they can do is take the step in front of them, and then the next hold comes in reach. Right? It's to take the step you can take. And the next step is almost always really clear for each one of us. You know, increasing a continuity of mindful presence, increasing, you know, our capacity for micro-renunciation. You know, there's nothing like non-clinging for the little things, right? Will they actually listen to me in this conversation, or will I actually get some coffee in the restaurant? The little things. That's really great to practice on, to be all right if it doesn't happen. It's okay to wish for it, but not be attached to it. You know, those are edges of practice. So if we don't have the jhanas, okay, but gosh, we have so much else we can work on, you know, including, gosh, just being kinder and less contentious and reactive to other people.
Yeah. I just have something to add to that. I'm going to go on retreat with Charlotte Catherine in a couple months. So yeah. When she was here, I asked her what I should do to prepare, and she said, of course, a daily practice. But she also said to try to keep my mind as free as possible from negative thoughts and experiences. And she used, for example, scary movies. She said, if your family watches scary movies, just go in another room.
Thank you. Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Are there dangers of delusion? I mean, normally we're not going to achieve the jhanas just casually, but, you know, doing a daily practice. You know, it doesn't seem like that happens in Buddhism particularly, that, you know, particular types really kind of get deluded about bliss and who they are, and, you know, think that they're enlightened because they've achieved a jhana. It seems like in Buddhism it's much more almost the other way. Yeah.
That's been my observation too. Probably other people have seen it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's always an exception to the rule. But yeah, you're right. I think what's nice is the moral rigor. I mean, for one thing, people have really talked about the role of sila, virtue. And that's a little detail that people like Alan Wallace have pointed out. It's actually really important to not underestimate. In other words, when Buddhism came to America, people were very interested in mindfulness and theory, you know, the wisdom. They really went after wisdom. A lot of Daylongs are about the wisdom element, you know, the teachings and how to understand yourself and think about how to think about things, great. But they tend to not be a lot about restraint or the precepts or the challenging moral implications of the first precept, to not intentionally take the life of any living being. You know, so that's a plug, I guess, for really paying attention to that. It actually goes to this last slide. You might want to take a look at it, just about wisdom, and it's headlined Wisdom and Virtue, in which Ani Tenzin Palmo, English woman who spent 12 years on retreat in a cave in Tibet, gotta respect anyone who would do that, and then another 12 on retreat in different ways. Wonderful book, Reflections in a Mountain Lake, very plain spoken, very direct, very good humored. As she says here, you know, wisdom, we do experience little breakthroughs. We often do get little flashes, you know, of unconditioned mind. But to stabilize them, that's the question. And to really do that, it really helps to have a mind that is quiet, which, much as Anne was saying, it really helps to have a mind that's quiet, and one in which it's not disturbed by anything, including guilt or contentiousness with other people. And boy, sila, restraint, wise speech, It really helps us have a mind where we're not troubled by remorse or, you know, irritable, contentious case-making about other people. How about maybe one or two more questions, comments, and then we'll close with a meditation? Yeah.
The other part that I struggled with a little bit with this afternoon's meditation was coming back out. I liked being in equanimity so much that when I came back up, it seemed kind of disruptive and not that pleasant as it felt going in.
Really?
Do you recommend coming out through to the stages?
Well, how else would you come out? You mean just kind of pop into regular state of mind? Is that what you mean?
No. I mean, maybe trying to maintain some of that equanimity for here. For not just on the pillow, but retaining the equanimity for every day.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah. I think that, I guess what I meant is, and it's also what I've been instructed to do, and it seemed to make sense to me, is we, and I appreciate you actually helping me do a better job, really, of clarifying this important thing, which is that however deep we go, I mean, don't you still feel it? I still feel it. We have that with us, and as we have it with us, maybe in the background, we bring into the foreground these steps kind of on the way out. So we have that equanimity and that singleness with us, that deep peace, while we access tranquility and then contentment, you know, and then happiness and maybe a memory of bliss and then kind of a more everyday mind. But we carry it with it. We don't necessarily let go. But what I would say about that is that this whole, I have found the instructions about differentiating rapture, happiness, contentment, and tranquility, and then singleness, to be very useful to me going in. Not so useful coming back out. So maybe that's what you're getting at. They're not so necessary coming back out. And again, see what works for you. Yeah. Sometimes I have found, paradoxically, it helps to change the order, to start with akagata, to start with singleness. Just kind of go right there. Like, it's all one thing. Wow. Then the mind starts getting really quiet, you know, like right there. And so you just, or on that day, you know, also you'll find different things work on different days. One thing I really want to put a plug in, though, for is being able to turn on the switch of positive emotion. And that's a wonderful faculty. If it's not there, maybe because there's depression, do what you can. Don't get depressed because you can't not be depressed. I mean, then you're in a second dart, right? Cascade, using the Buddha's metaphor. But as much as you can, working on that positive emotional state, it's really, really good. Because then increasingly you'll be able to generate happiness at will, you know, kind of unconditionally. Or the condition is that you deliberately activate it, but that's it. It's not contingent on your circumstances. All right? Well, how about we close with some loving kindness and, you know, kind of take some of this steadiness of mind and positive being. And as we settle in, I want to just flag something. The very beginning of those suggestions were to have compassion for yourself, I think in the previous meditation. And I just want to call out self-compassion. We'll talk more about this. It gets at this question of how to be selfless in a business world, if you will. And, you know, as Pema Chodron says, her quote is, the root of Buddhism is compassion. That's a Mahayana view for sure, Tibetan view. But the root of Buddhism is compassion, and the root of compassion is compassion for oneself. And there's been research increasingly on self-compassion. It's actually more powerful than self-esteem, partly because it's emotional. So when we do, you know, loving-kindness, you know, we do it for ourselves as well as for others. So I will offer a couple of little suggestions, then I'll be quiet. So let's get settled. So I'll just mention, because most of you know this, that you can use words in your mind to focus your kindness and compassion, which also tend to kind of come together in practice. Or you can simply have wordless wishes. Compassion, that beings not suffer. Kindness, that beings be happy. And in addition to the wishes, there may well be some warm-heartedness toward beings. The wishes traditionally tend to fall into four types. I'll say them in this way. May you be safe. May you be healthy. May you be happy. May you live with ease. Those wishes can be expressed in many different kinds of ways, and it's perfectly fine to just focus on one. And then again, traditionally, there are several types of people these wishes are applied toward. First, a benefactor, someone who has really helped us. Second, a friend, broadly defined, could be a mate, a child. Third, a neutral person. Perhaps someone we don't know at all, or someone we know very peripherally. Fourth, a difficult person, someone that's difficult for us. And then last, ourself. So as you wish, you might bring loving kindness and or compassion to one or more of those different types of people, expressing it in any way that you like. And we'll do this for 10 minutes or so, and then end today. May our sincere efforts today help free ourselves and others from suffering and its causes. May your mind and heart be both steady and contented. I really appreciated you today and hope to see you tomorrow, but I certainly appreciated this today. Thank you so much. And I suspect we may have an announcement about our potluck.